leverage to get away. It just took about 10% off the top. He opened his eye, but could not see her. She was on his left, the reverse of where she'd been earlier that morning. He shifted slightly and felt her lips against his left cheek. His stomach went cold.
"What are you doing?"
"Kissing your face."
"Why that side?"
"It's still your face, right?"
"That's how much you know. That skin came from my thigh."
He hoped the reality of that unfortunate detail might create its own distance.
If I was kissing your thigh, would I be getting these kinds of complaints?
And then it happened again, a touch of lips brushing just underneath the patch, upsetting his stomach.
"Arlene, this is making me uncomfortable."
"Is there anything I could do that wouldn't make you uncomfortable?"
Indignation rose in her voice, oddly comfortable in its familiarity. The rest of this, though, was too strange and new.
"You could let me up."
She had been leaning against his side, pinning his left arm, making him feel trapped. But she didn't stay that way for long. She stood in a row by the window while Reuben attempted to locate his shoes.
"You know what your problem is?"
He met her eyes.
"I say that a lot, don't I?"
"Probably just to me. I have a lot of problems."
"You sure make it hard to like you."
He wanted to say, "Then why don't you give up?" But in some small part of himself, he feared that if he asked her to, she might. He found his shoes and opened the bedroom door.
"Why are you mad at me, Reuben? Why are you leaving like you're mad? What the hell did I do wrong?"
He walked down the hall toward the front door and bumped into Trevor, in his pajamas, headed for the bathroom, with a cowlick in the back of his hair where he'd slept on it funny. And there was nowhere to hide, no way not to be seen.
"Morning, Mr. St. Clair,"
he said, and locked the bathroom door behind him, leaving Reuben to wonder what he'd expected and why the experience had come up missing. Just as he touched the knob of the front door, Arlene caught him from behind with a hand on his shoulder.
"So, are you still coming back tonight?"
"Arlene, this is a mistake."
He wouldn't turn around to say it, just stood facing the street, as if he was breaking up with her front door.
"I don't know why we ever started with this."
"You want to come back? I'll explain it to you."
He shook his head without turning around. He stood in front of his first class, stomach unsettled and eye grainy from lack of sleep.
"Today is the deadline for the extra credit assignment. I'd like to see a show of hands. How many of you chose to participate?"
Mary Ann Tellman's hand shot up first, closely followed by another girl named Jamie, who wore muted colors and tended to sit in the back and blend in with the walls. Then a boy named Jason, who liked to express his difficult growth phase by hitting and who needed all the extra credit he could get. After a second or two, Arnie Jenkins raised his hand cautiously, the big, awkward, brutish boy who'd asked Reuben if he was a pirate.
"Chose to?"
Arnie asked.
"Or really did?"
"Did you participate, Arnie?"
"Well, I chose to. I could use the extra credit, but I couldn't think of anything. I really tried, though."
"Hard to document trying, Arnie. I think you'd better put your hand down."
Reuben glanced at Trevor, who was staring at the wall on his right at close range.
"Trevor?"
Trevor made a face and raised his hand.
"Is that it? 4? Out of a class of 39? Well, congratulations to the 4 of you for making the effort. Now, you documented your work on paper the way I asked you to. Would you pass those forward, please? Then we'll present the ideas to the class. Mary Ann, would you like to go first?"
Reuben knew she would. She stood in front of the class as though she'd always known she belonged there and had never quite felt comfortable anywhere else.
"Well, the Earth only has just so many resources. So recycling is very important. And we don't have curbside recycling here in Atascadero. So I gather some recycling bins, not enough for everybody in the city, of course, but enough for probably everybody who cares enough to ask for one. We put little ads on the bulletin boards around town, at the Lucky and the Kmart, saying we had them for free."
Reuben interrupted briefly.
"We?"
Oh, my father sort of drove me around. And then I wrote a letter to the city council encouraging curbside recycling, and I got it signed by 40 of my neighbors. There's a copy of the letter in with my paper, Mr. St. Clair.
Thank you, Mary Ann. I'll take a look at that. What about you, Jason?
Jason walked up the aisle slowly, pausing to kick another boy's foot.
Some people think we don't have gangs in Atascadero, but they're wrong. I mean, look at the graffiti. That's called tagging.
He turned toward Reuben as he said this, as though everyone else in the room would know.
It's kind of gang talk, like bragging. So I went to the store owners who got tagged and said, if you pay for the paint, I'll paint over it. Some of it showed up again the next day, but I painted over it again. One store I did 3 times. But after a while, I guess the taggers just got tired of doing it over.
You wrote down all the businesses for me, Jason?
Yeah, it's all there, Mr. St. Clair.
That's good, Jason. I'm impressed. Thank you.
Not that the project was unusually impressive. It was more a consider-the-source observation. Mary Ann Tellman seemed to get her nose out of joint when he said that, but truthfully, he had not been impressed by her project. Earlier in the semester, it had come clear to Reuben that her father did most of the work. Gathered recycling bins, she'd said. Interesting euphemism for what a parent provides. Trevor sat staring at the wall again. Reuben knew it would be a bad moment for Trevor, so he saved him for last, the way he might postpone his own pain if he'd had that choice.
Jamie?
Jamie shifted on her feet and stammered,
I went to the Oak Tree Retirement Home and talked to some of the people there, and a lot of what they told me I wrote down, like a story of their life, so the class could read about them. Because sometimes young people don't know that old people have a lot to say. If I could use a copy machine in the office, I could make one for everybody. I couldn't do it at the copy place. It would have been too expensive. It's almost 20 pages long.
Thank you, Jamie. Why don't you talk to Principal Morgan during lunch today? See if she'll let you.
Okay.
She hurried back to her seat. Reuben looked at Trevor, and Trevor looked at him. Reuben felt a pang of embarrassment, remembering bumping into him in the hall outside his bedroom earlier that morning. But Trevor hadn't mentioned that. Trevor took a deep breath and trudged to the front of the classroom, moving slowly and warily, like he was walking a gangplank. Reuben felt his own face flush, as if the presentation, the pressure, were his own. Trevor stood in front of the class and sighed.
I put a lot of time and energy into my project, he said. But it didn't turn out like I wanted.
Looking quiet and empty, he turned to the blackboard and sketched out a simple version of paying forward. He used Reuben's pointer to indicate the first circle.
This was Jerry. I helped him get a job, but then he violated his parole. I don't know if you can pay it forward in prison. I guess you can, because I guess the people in there need a favor more than anybody, but I don't know if he will. Then, this was Mrs. Greenberg. I spent about 3 whole days fixing up her garden, only she died.
Arnie spoke out of turn, shouted,
I wonder if you could pay it forward in heaven.
The class laughed and hooted, and Trevor exchanged a look with Reuben as though begging him to make it stop. Reuben slammed his right hand on the desktop, hard. Trevor jumped.
Those of you who did not bother to participate will please stop making light of those who tried.
The class stared at Reuben in stony silence, most with their mouths open. It was the first break in his calm even-handedness, and Reuben knew by the looks on their faces that he'd just become the human equivalent of Lou's flying yardstick.
Please go on, Trevor.
Oh, okay. Well, there was a third one, too, but I'm not quite sure how good an idea that was. Anyway, I'm going to come up with 3 more people. You know, start over.
Mary Ann Tellman raised her hand.
But Mr. St. Clair, the deadline is past. He can't do anything about it now.
Trevor stiffened to her challenge.
I'm not doing it for the credit, Mary Ann. I'm doing it to see if the world really changes.
He glanced at Reuben again for support, and Reuben gave him a subtle signal, pushing down with his hand as if to say, settle down, don't rise to this. Arnie raised his hand and jumped in.
But you can't change the world on the honor system. Shoot, anybody knows that. Leave people on the honor system, they don't do it. As soon as you look away, they just don't. I mean, look what happened.
Trevor rushed to his own defense again, tight and bristly now, as if being attacked from every side.
It's not Mrs. Greenberg's fault that she died, Arnie.
Well, people die, or they go to jail, or they just goof off. What's the difference? They still don't do it.
All right. That's enough discussion. It's easy to stand here and criticize Trevor's idea because he had problems with the result, but it was still the best idea, especially since most of you didn't even have one. Now, I'll look these over tonight. The best effort earns an automatic A in this class. Everybody who participated will see a positive effect on his or her grade.
But as Trevor returned to his desk and found his place in the textbook, the discussion continued in scattered whispers. He ran into Ann Morgan in the hall at the end of the following Friday. She said she'd told Jamie she could copy the stories in the office, and if he had just a moment, could Reuben come into her office for a chat? It had that "let's talk" ring to it, two words never followed by anything joyous or good. He sat in the chair across from her desk, the same hot seat he'd occupied on his first day, feeling only slightly more comfortable now.
"Now, Reuben, I don't want you to think this is a problem in my eyes. I just need to pass this along to you. I got a very strong complaint from Mary Ann Tellman's parents today."
"Don't tell me. Let me guess. They think their little princess should have gotten the winning grade."
"Yes, but that's not the end of it. They're upset because Trevor McKinney did. They claim that's inappropriate in light of the fact that you and Arlene McKinney are, dating."
An awkward pause, during which neither spoke or met the other's eyes.
"Which I didn't even know you were. And I'm not questioning you on that. What you do with your personal life is none of my business, Reuben. I'm uncomfortable even talking to you about it. But you have to know the complaint was lodged."
"What did you tell them?"
"That I would discuss it with you and determine whether any bias was involved in the grading. Which I already know there wasn't, because I know that's not the kind of teacher you are."
"Where do they come by their information? I feel like I'm under some kind of surveillance."
"You've never lived in a small town before, have you? Atascadero might not be so small that everybody literally knows everybody, but all the faces become commonplace, and a new one stands out."
"Especially mine. Oh, sorry, I'm doing it again. So, in other words, I go to dinner or a movie with someone, and the next day people are discussing it amongst themselves."
"I'm afraid so."
Reuben's lack of sleep seemed to tackle him suddenly, a quick fade that left him feeling weak and slightly sick. But he breathed deeply and filled Anne in on the basics of paying forward. She listened carefully and seemed impressed with the scope of Trevor's idea.
"The purpose of that assignment was to get the students thinking globally," he said. "Jamie came up with an idea to change the consciousness of the class. Marianne and Jason tried to change the Atascadero. Trevor had the only idea that might have gotten bigger than this town. He was criticized because the results weren't good, but the Tellmans can't swear that the city will adopt curbside recycling either. That shouldn't negate the effort, which, by the way, in Marianne's case was more her father's effort than her own. So I'm supposed to kick Trevor while he's down and punish him for the fact that old people die and junkies don't stay clean and you can't cure anyone else's loneliness?"
"You didn't tell me about that last one."
"Oh, well, I'm sketchy on the details. And also, for your information, Arlene McKinney and I dated a handful of times. Dated. And that's all we did. And that's over now and ended uncomfortably, and I think more has been made of that situation than the facts warrant."
"That part was never my business, Reuben. But I'll tell the Tellmans I discussed the students' projects with you and that I approve of the priorities involved in your grading."
"That's not even just the beauty of the idea, Anne. If you could have seen how hard he worked. He put over $100 of his own money into that homeless man and more than 30 hours on the old woman's garden. He was so hurt and disappointed."
Anne watched him carefully as he spoke. And he saw something forming in her eyes, something about him, as though he was looking in a mirror. Then she repeated the observation in words.
"You really care for that boy, don't you, Reuben?"
"Well, yes, I do. But that doesn't change the facts."
But Anne was already convinced that no bias existed. So Reuben must have been talking to himself. From the Diary of Trevor.
"Sometimes I still think about Jerry. I wonder if they let him out of jail by now. And if they did, I wonder why he didn't come back here and say hello. Sometimes I think maybe it wasn't his fault. Maybe the police just expected something bad from him, so they looked real hard and found it. Maybe if he was cleaner, they would have been looking at somebody else to arrest. Or maybe he really blew it. Sometimes I think maybe he wasn't my friend at all, that he just said he was, for the money. But I hate to think that. So I like to pretend that he couldn't get back here somehow, like they let him off real far from home, and so he's just out there somewhere, paying it forward. I know he's probably not. I just like to think it.
Chapter 13. Charlotte. She left her car in the park on the Marin County side and walked down the off-ramp. Walked out onto the bridge in the northbound traffic lane because the pedestrian gates were closed. It was after 3 in the morning, with traffic on the bridge sparse to non-existent. Every now and then a car would come by and she'd try to make herself small. There's a trick, she thought. Me, small. Apparently her therapist was right. She was so accustomed to making jokes, she couldn't stop if she tried. Even in her own head, even when everything was terribly unfunny. It would be just like her to think of a joke about falling on the way down. She looked over the reddish bridge railing. Beneath her in the moonlight, she could see land. She wasn't over water yet, and there was no platform beneath this part of the bridge. It would be easier here, she thought, with no platform. But no, not here. Something about that hard ground. Not here. A van came by. She turned to assure herself that it would drive on in spite of her, convinced that anyone who saw her would understand her purpose. That's when she saw that she was being followed. He wasn't close behind her, but he was definitely following. She'd thought about this. Going out at night, even if it was for the last time. It wasn't safe in this city at night. Splattering herself against the icy surface of the bay, that was one thing. But life held worse surprises than death, and she, of all people, should know it. She glanced over her shoulder again. He hadn't gained any ground. Little guy, she thought. What was she so worried about? At 5'10", carrying 40 extra pounds on her already considerable frame, maybe she could take him. Unless he had a knife. Or a gun. Last time the guy had a gun. Little guy, but well-armed. She glanced again. Maybe she'd been wrong. Maybe he was just walking over the bridge, oblivious to her. Yeah, right, I should be so lucky. There was only one thing to do, and it was exactly what she'd planned to do all along. She leaped up to the railing and pulled herself over. There was a platform under the edge of the bridge, that much she already knew. She'd staked out this spot in advance. It wasn't far down. But now, in the middle of the night, with a potential violent rapist's footsteps clicking on the pavement behind her, it looked a lot farther down than she'd remembered. She tried to turn around, to climb down, but a great fear of falling hamstrung her movements. Good one, Charlotte. Fear of falling. The first fall is the easy one. He was getting closer. She could almost make out his face in the darkness now, his footsteps coming faster. Dirty and seedy. A real lowlife. Okay, think fast. She pushed off the rail and jumped kamikaze style to the platform below. Remembering to bend her knees on impact was not enough. She landed too hard. Overbalanced forward, grabbed onto the edge, seized by that sickening feeling like falling. She felt a twist in her ankle, felt something give. Not bad enough to be a broken bone, she thought, but it smarted. And she sat rubbing it, wondering why it should matter now. When she looked up, he was leaning over the railing, looking down at her. Don't come near me, she thought. I know the perfect escape.
You okay?
I think I hurt myself.
Oh, smart, Charlotte. Good. I'm injured prey. Come get me. Good thinking.
You think that's a bad fall? The next one's a killer.
Very funny. What makes you think I'm going to jump?
What the hell you come out here for?
Well, you're out here. Were you going to jump?
No. I was going to try to talk you out of it.
You were? Why?
He didn't answer. and Charlotte's insides leaped and froze to see him start over the railing after her. "Don't come down here. I'll do it. I mean it. If you come down here, I'll jump."
"I ain't gonna hurt you. I just want to talk about this."
He didn't fit the pattern. His voice, his manner held none of the implied violence she'd learned to smell. Still, she didn't exactly trust him. He did much better than she had, turning around and shinnying down to the bottom of the rail. Then he went limp and dropped lightly onto the platform beside her, not 5 feet away. Easy for him, she thought. Skinny little guy. Probably didn't weigh more than 120 pounds. He must have seen her panic. Too bad. She thought she had a damn good poker face.
"Hey, look, lady, I didn't come down here to give you no trouble. I just thought we could talk about this. I mean, what do you got to lose? I try to convince you life is worth living. If I don't do so good, you jump. Nothing ventured, right?"
"How'd you know I was going to jump?"
"What else would you be doing out here in the middle of the night? A lady out here by herself, San Francisco, in the middle of the night? I mean, that's suicide, one way or the other."
"What were you doing out here?"
"Waiting for somebody like you to try something stupid. I've been sleeping in that park over there, mostly during the day, sitting up at night, waiting for a jumper. Sooner or later, there's going to be a jumper. Tonight's my lucky night. I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. Jerry Busconi."
He held one dirty hand out. She shook it anyway.
"Charlotte Rinaldi."
His face lit up.
"Oh, Italian, huh? See, we got something in common."
"Why do you care if somebody jumps off the bridge?"
"That's a funny question. It's a life. A human life."
"Not yours."
"No, not mine. Gosh, it's pretty out here tonight, huh? Real clear night."
It had never occurred to Charlotte to look until he said that. He was right. It was beautiful. Clear and clean smelling from the recent rains, which had moved through, headed south, leaving the stars out in numbers. Enough moon to see Alcatraz. And the lights of the city pressed together, cluttering the hill. Moon on the water. Sausalito on the other side, the dark shape of landmasses in the night. She looked straight down at the dark water, and something came out of nowhere. A huge something right underneath her, monstrous in its size and suddenness. It startled her, and she stumbled backward. Jerry laughed.
"Ain't that a kick when that happens? That's one of them Norwegian ones, I think. Freighter. Dutch, I forget. Wallenius lines, I think. Big puppy, huh? Kind of scares you, popping out of nowhere like that."
"Why are you trying to help me?" She didn't look at him as she asked this. She leaned forward to watch more and more of the deck of that monstrous freighter appear underneath. The platform felt terrifyingly narrow.
"Good thing you didn't jump right then. Makes some deckhand mighty unhappy."
"Very funny."
Sometimes you got a joke. What else can you do?"
"That's what I always say. And people tell me I'm being inappropriate. My therapist says I'm minimizing my own trauma."
You want to go get a cup of coffee and talk about it? On me."
Charlotte shook her head. The freighter had moved forward now and away, completely visible, leaving dark water just underneath.
"You know, that's the prettiest part of the view," she said.
"What is?"
"That black water right down there. That is a very comfortable darkness."
Now that's where you're wrong. Just wait till you get down there. That's a very ugly darkness. Very cold. Unforgiving. You won't like it one bit."
"Better than where I've been. But how would you know?"
"Hey, I've been down. Don't I look to you like a guy who's been down? I mean, just about every bad shit could happen to a person has happened to me. My life is shit."
"Well, thank you so much, Jerry, for coming down here to convince me that life is worth living."
"See, that's just the point, though."
He pulled his dark, ratty coat tighter around himself against the cold. A piece of torn lining hung down onto his jeans.
"I mean, if my life is worth living, then yours has got to be better than you think."
"You don't know anything about my life, mister. You have no idea what I've been through."
"No, that's true. But the offer still holds. We go get a cup of coffee, you can tell me all about it."
Charlotte didn't answer. Tears began to flow now, running down her face, tickling slightly as they dripped off the end of her chin. They'd been away for as long as she could remember. She leaned forward, allowing them to drop into the dark water. So far down.
I'm going to tell you a little story, Charlotte Rinaldi, whether you want to hear it or not. A few months ago, I was like at the lowest place I'd ever been in my life, even though I've been lower since. And somebody I didn't even know came along and tried to help me, just out of nowhere. Gave me money to eat and buy new clothes and get a job. Didn't want me to pay him back. I was supposed to do something that big for 3 more people. That's called paying it forward. Just think what could happen with that if people really did it. And let's say you don't jump. You pay it forward to 3 people. And they do 9. And they do 27. And then 2 more people I might find to help, they do their bit. Think about it. After a while, nobody could jump off a bridge anymore because there'd be somebody there just looking for the chance to do their bit, you know? Anyway, I screwed it all up. Took the help and made a mess. I was so ashamed I couldn't even look this kid in the face.
He was a kid?
Yeah. How about that, huh? A 12-year-old kid. Out of the mouths of babes, right? But then I thought, well, so I screwed it up. I mean, I'm a junkie, Charlotte. I'm always going to be a junkie. I ain't never going to be no fine, upstanding citizen. But then I thought, hell, just pay forward anyway. Kid tried to help me. Okay, didn't work. Still, I'm trying to help you. Maybe you'll jump. I don't know. But I tried, right? But let me tell you one thing. I woke up one morning and somebody gave me a chance. Just out of nowhere. It was like a miracle. Now, how do you know that won't happen to you tomorrow? How do you know? What if you jump into that icy cold water and turns out this big miracle was coming your way tomorrow? You'd miss out. Wouldn't you just kick yourself?
Charlotte wiped her nose on her sleeve inconspicuously. She sobbed one more time, then laughed out loud.
No, I guess I wouldn't, Cherry. I'd be dead. I'd never have to kick myself again.
Well, up to you.
He rose to leave. Charlotte looked up, wondering what she would do then. Could he really climb back up? Probably. But she knew she couldn't. It involved pulling up your full body weight with your arms. But why was she even thinking of that, she wondered. Was she changing her mind?
Tell you what, Charlotte. Do this one thing, just for me. Flip a coin on it. Let chance tell you what to do. Heads, come get a cup of coffee with me. Tails, splat on the bay.
It may have been a release of tension, but it seemed like the funniest idea to her. She couldn't stop laughing once she'd gotten started. It made her hiccup once.
You know you're pretty when you laugh.
That killed it. She glared at him defensively.
Hey, I didn't mean nothing by it. I just said you're pretty. You got a pretty face.
Charlotte snorted. That's what they always say about a big plum girl. She has a pretty face.
You want me to decide living or dying on a flip of a coin?
Yes, I do.
That's the stupidest idea I ever heard in my life.
Why? Why is it stupid? At least my way, you got a 50-50 chance.
He held a coin out to her in the dark, placed it in her hand. She stared closely at it. A quarter, head side up. What if it didn't come down that way? She'd really have to do it. Well, something had to break, one way or another. Something finally had to make up her mind.
Okay. Here it goes.
Her heart pounded. Blood roared in her ears. She levered her thumb under the quarter, flipped the coin up into the air. It arced too far out, and she missed it. They both leaned over the edge of the steel platform as far as they dared and watched the coin fall, turning end over end to the water below. But it disappeared because the water was too dark, too far down. She didn't hear the splash because it was too far away. A shiver ran through her.
You're right, she said. That's a bad darkness.
Shoot, my quarter.
Christ, Cherry, it's just a quarter. Here, here's a dollar.
She pulled the bill out of her pocket and stuffed it in his hand, hoping that in the dark she hadn't just given him a 10.
Oh, that was special. That was my two-headed quarter.
but she noticed he pocketed the bill just the same.
Two-headed quarter?
Yeah.
Where do you get a two-headed quarter?
I don't know. That's the whole problem. That was unreplaceable.
Well, where did you get that one?
I stole it off a guy at a bar.
Huh. Sorry.
Ah, shoot. Well, it's okay, I guess. Only you better not jump now. If you do, and I lose you and my two-headed quarter, then I'd be pissed.
Charlotte rubbed her ankle, and they sat for a few minutes, and she looked around again. At Marin, and the city side, and the lights, like somebody was alive out there, thinking it looked more inviting than that cold, dark chasm that had eaten Jerry's two-headed quarter.
So you know someplace you can get a coffee at this hour?
Hell yeah, this is the city.
I don't know if I can climb up from here.
That ain't so hard.
I hurt my ankle, though.
I'll help you.
It took a while, but they ended up on the concrete walkway of the bridge again, though Charlotte never could have done it without him.
Chapter 14. Arlene. She stood on his front porch with one hand poised to knock and her heart beating so hard she could hear it in her ears. She hadn't done anything wrong, which was just exactly what she had stopped by to tell him, so why was she so afraid he'd tell her to go to hell? Exactly when had this thing taken a wrong turn again? Arlene decided she must have been in some other room when it all happened without her. She rapped hard on his front door and immediately wanted to run away. In fact, she'd taken two steps back when he opened the door. He was wearing dark blue sweatpants and a snug, plain white T-shirt.
Arlene.
Reuben, do you think I'm easy?
No. Actually, I find you quite difficult.
Then he leaned back on the doorframe and smiled. And she couldn't take offense at what he'd said because it was a nice smile, even though the left corner of his mouth didn't go along. So he must have been teasing her in a nice way.
Well, there goes the pot calling the kettle black. Can I come in for just a minute?
The smile dropped away.
Oh. It's a mess.
Your place? Don't get serious. You're not the type to have a mess.
He opened the door just a little wider to show her the inside of his living room, all stacked with cardboard moving cartons.
I haven't quite unpacked yet.
Well, hell, Reuben, that ain't a mess. It's not your fault if all your stuff just got here, right?
Right,
he said, still not sounding too sure of himself. But he stepped back from the doorway and let her in.
Why would I think you're easy?
Hell, I don't know. I never know what you're thinking anyway. Just wanted to make sure you didn't.
She found herself a place on the couch.
Are you easy?
Well, no. Well, I don't think so. Well, not by my standards. I get along fine with sex. It's not that, but if I'm with one guy, then he's the only guy. Ricky's been gone over a year, and I still haven't been with anybody else. That doesn't exactly make me promiscuous. What about you?
No, I'm not exactly promiscuous either. Can I get you something to drink? Would you like a beer?
Oh, I'd love one to pieces, but no. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was stupid of me.
Well, you didn't know.
I noticed you never ordered drinks, but I didn't think about it.
We still don't really know each other all that well.
That was the other part of what she'd come to tell him. That he kept himself so shuttered off from her that he felt like a stranger, which might have been why she'd ended up feeling cheap.
I've got orange juice and ginger ale.
Ginger ale would be fine.
He went off to get it, and she sat, chewing on the edge of her thumbnail, telling herself to stop it, but not stopping. At least he hadn't told her to go to hell. When he handed her the cold glass, she said,
"What did I do wrong, Reuben? I have no idea. What was wrong with kissing that side of your face, anyway? It's all you. I was just sort of, you know, accepting it as part of you."
He sat down beside her, perched on the edge of his seat, the way he did whenever something made him uncomfortable.
Well,
see, he wasn't a total stranger. She knew that much about him.
I'm not sure I can explain it.
Know what Trevor told me? He said you told him that it's better not to pretend like you didn't notice, because that doesn't fool you one bit anyway. And you know, when he said that, it made total sense. I thought, shoot, I've been doing it wrong all these years. I'm sure not going to make that mistake again. So I didn't treat that side of your face like it didn't exist. So you left in a huff, and I ain't heard from you since.
I'm sorry.
You are?
She hadn't thought he would be. She'd thought somehow she'd come out sorry, the guilty one. That's the way it usually went.
Oh. Well, that's okay. Just kind of hurt my feelings some at the time.
He took a little slide over to her and gave her a hug. He'd never done that before. And she'd always wanted him to. And always noticed that missing. So why, now that it was here, did it seem to make her feel a little uneasy? He didn't let go right away, either. Just held on for a minute, making Arlene think maybe she'd cry again. And if she did, he'd have to think she was some kind of emotional basket case, always crying at the drop of a hat.
You're right, he said,
his mouth up close to her ear.
I get angry when people pretend they don't notice, and I get angry when I know they do. I'm not sure what I want from people. I think I want them not to jump a mile when they first see me, and I'm never going to get that.
Then he let go. And sure enough, by that time, she was crying, because she felt so bad for him. Which, in a way, but a way she'd never tried to explain, was the reason she'd kissed his face that morning, feeling bad for him. Like Trevor with a skinned knee. Like she'd been a mommy too long and thought she could make it all better if she kissed it. He didn't have any reaction to her tears, and she wondered if she wanted him to notice, or if she wanted him to pretend not to. It was a hard problem. He was right about that. Then he said,
Arlene, I've got a confession to make. These boxes didn't just arrive. They've been here for months. I just can't bring myself to unpack them. I've moved 3 times in the past 4 years. I get so tired of it. Every time I try to unpack, I just get overwhelmed.
She stared at him and wiped tears out from under her eyes, sideways and carefully so she wouldn't smear her mascara.
That is so wonderful.
What is?
That you told me that. That's the first real thing you ever told me about yourself. And what's even better, I can totally relate to that. Not with moving, but hell, I feel that way about all kinds of things. I just get overwhelmed. Immobile-like.
And Reuben said,
Yeah, like that.
And they smiled at each other and got embarrassed again.
Maybe it would be easier if you weren't doing it alone. I could help you unpack.
You'd do that?
Of course I would. Hell, what are friends for? Just let me use your phone a minute. Tell Trevor where I am.
Of course, the first thing Trevor said was could he come over and help, too. So Arlene put her hand over the phone and asked Reuben if he could. Reuben said yes, of course. But additionally, he got this sweet look on his face, like he really liked Trevor, which Arlene already knew, but every time she saw it, she liked it better than the time before. He had good taste in kids. There was that to be said for him. Trevor got deeply involved in a box of books. He arranged them on Reuben's bookshelf alphabetically, according to the name of the author. This seemed to impress Reuben, and it amazed the hell out of Arlene, who knew he didn't get this knack for organization from her side of the family. She stood in Reuben's kitchen, unpacking better-than-everyday china, handing it up to Reuben, who arranged it on the high shelves. She felt so short beside him, like he was standing on a chair, which he was not. A little half-Siamese cat with blue eyes came mewing around her feet, and Arlene bent down to pet her. The cat arched her back and purred.
I didn't know you had a cat.
That's Miss Liza.
They hadn't said anything for a long time, and after saying that, they fell silent again. The light through the windows went murky with a coming rain. Then she opened the box with the pictures. They were all framed and laid flat, wrapped in newspapers. She unwrapped the top one. It was a photograph of a nice-looking young couple, a handsome young black man, hardly more than a boy, with his arm around a pretty girl. And the man looked a little familiar, almost like Reuben. When she looked up, he was over near the closet, looking back at her, watching her look.
Is this your brother, Reuben?
I don't have a brother. That's me.
Oh.
Boy, what a stupid thing to say, Arlene.
Oh.
but it was a shock, one she hadn't nearly adjusted to yet. She must have known, somewhere in the back of her mind, that he wasn't born with his face blown up. But she'd never thought about it, and certainly never expected to see what he'd looked like before, when he was still whole. So she just kept looking, and he just stood by the closet, watching her look.
"Who's this pretty lady?"
"Eleanor. She was my fiancé at the time."
"But you never got married?"
"No. I've never been married."
"No, me neither."
She had to tell him that sooner or later, and it just sort of came out. Eleanor seemed about two shades darker in skin color than Reuben. Smooth, shiny black skin, and her hair all drawn back, looking stylish, like somebody with a world of class. Like somebody Arlene never was and never could be. Like somebody Reuben really should be with. Arlene couldn't seem to get a bead on which face hurt her more.
"I can't believe how handsome you were." "Oh, God, I'm sorry, Reuben. Sometimes I say the stupidest things."
She looked over at Trevor, preoccupied with his bookshelf, to see if he was taking in any of this very personal stuff. He was not. He was lost in his own little world.
"Wouldn't it be nice if I still looked like that?"
"No."
She hadn't known she was going to say that. It just sort of said itself. And the funny thing was, he didn't ask her to explain. He just stuck his head in the closet and went on about his unpacking. From The Other Faces Behind the Movement.
"Because, you know, a man like that one in the picture, he would never so much as give me the time of day. He would never have shown up in a little hick town like this one in the first place. And if he had, he'd be with that handsome, sophisticated woman. And I just know he would speak down to me. It was real hard to stop staring at that picture. Hard to explain why. It felt like it had a hold of some place in my gut and it wouldn't let me go. I mean, it just put a whole lot of things in a whole different light. And then, when I got over that, there was the one of Reuben's parents. They were real good-looking, too. And they seemed to have that same something, that same thing Eleanor had. And I couldn't even say for sure what it was, but as much I did know, Reuben had it, and I did not. He'd never lose it, and I'd never learn it. Some things start out a certain way and never change. I asked Reuben if they were still alive, his parents. He said they were, that they lived in Chicago. Oh, thank God, I thought. Now I'll probably not have to meet them. And if I never met them, I would never read on their faces that I was not Eleanor material and never would be. And then, even though I tried not to, after a while I set Reuben's parents down and picked up that first picture again. While I stared at it, I thought about my mother and the way she used to shop. We didn't have much money, see, when I was growing up, so she'd buy seconds, different types of damaged goods, rather than an item of clothing that was whole and unflawed, but essentially poorer in quality. "But Mama," I'd complain, "it's got a stain on it." And Mama would say, "Good thing for you it does, little girl, or we'd have never been able to afford it." Then I looked up at Reuben again, and he was still standing in the closet. And one more time, I caught him looking back at me. This hard rain started pounding on the roof.
She tucked her boy into bed at 10, since it was Saturday, and no school the following day. He asked if they could get a cat, and she avoided answering. A few minutes into the 11 o'clock news came the knock. The rain was really coming down now. She didn't even realize how much until she opened the door. It fell in sheets behind him, and he stood on her front porch, soaking wet, his hair, his clothes saturated, water dripping off his chin.
"You're sobbing wet. You better get in here."
He stepped inside, and she closed the door behind him.
"I'll get a towel."
She went through her bedroom into her own bathroom to get the big, cushy one. When she came out with it, he had followed her into the bedroom and was standing by the bed, dripping water onto the carpet. She sat him down on the edge of the bed and toweled his closely cropped hair.
Don't take this wrong, but what are you doing here?
I got lonely. It was the funniest thing. Something about having you and Trevor in the house with me all day. After you left, the house seemed so empty. I don't want to be alone anymore, Arlene.
As he said this last thing, he reached out for her and put his right hand around behind her back and pulled her up close. She set one knee on the bed beside him and held the back of his head, feeling the moisture from his wet clothes soak through her bathrobe. He didn't touch her in any intimate way, just held her close. But it felt intimate, very much so, the way his forehead pressed against her chest and his face just remained there between her breasts, his breath warm.
"Why didn't you take your umbrella, silly?"
She knew he had one. She'd unpacked it herself.
"I couldn't find it."
"I put it in your front closet."
"Oh, I didn't think of that."
A gentle kiss in the open V of her bathrobe, on the bony part of her chest, made it hard to swallow.
"Doesn't everybody keep their umbrella in the closet?"
"No, I don't."
"Where do you keep it?"
"In the umbrella stand."
"What umbrella stand?"
"That tall wicker thing."
"Oh, is that what that was? I thought that was some kind of big skinny planter. I put it on the back porch."
She could feel him lean back, still holding her to him. And if he'd gone all the way over backward on the bed, she'd have been on top of him, which she somehow could not manage on such short notice. So she resisted, without meaning to. He said,
"You seem tense."
"Do I?"
"Last time you were so sure."
"Yeah, well, somebody had to be."
He pulled his head back a little and she wiped his face with the towel, even though it was mostly wiped dry on her robe. Maybe she'd be lucky and wouldn't have to explain it. Maybe he'd just know somehow. If he asked, maybe she'd give the easy reason, not that it wasn't true. And it was hard, being stone cold sober and all, and used to having that painkiller to grease over the rough spots, which you cannot help but have when any two people are so new to each other. But most of it wasn't that. Most of it was, as far as she could tell, that she'd been wrong about what this could be. He was not an in-the-meantime kind of a man. And then, listening to the rain on the roof and pulling his head against her again and holding it there, she was able, by virtue of his presence, to help smooth over the moment, to know what she should have known all along. What she had known all along in a very deep spot where she knew better than to allow herself to go. Alone, anyway. That Ricky wasn't ever coming back. And even if he ever did, which he wouldn't, what kind of woman would she be if she opened the door? She leaned forward with him, and he ended up on his back on the bed with Arlene on top, and the handsome young man in the picture came back again, filling up her mind. She would never understand the forces that had brought him from there to here. It took her back to that place again, the one she didn't like, the one where she knew that, by all rights, he was something she should never have been able to afford. Chapter 15. Reuben. He woke up knowing full well where he was and remembering everything. Still, the night seemed distant, like something you do while drunk. Something harder to imagine in the sober morning. He opened his eye. She was on his right side, where she was supposed to be, wide awake and up on one elbow, watching him. He wanted to reach his hand out to see if she would take it, but he didn't.
"Hey,"
he said quietly.
"Hey."
"You okay?"
"Sure. Why wouldn't I be?"
They lay together for a time, silent, not touching in any way.
"You slept in that eye patch all night. Isn't that uncomfortable?
Actually, yes, it is.
Someday you'll have to take that off around me.
Someday.
Is it real bad?
This was not something he could explain. That it was not grisly, as people expected. Maybe they would have liked it better if it had been. Grisly or not, people liked some vestige of an eye, some evidence that it had at one time existed as nature intended.
It's both better and worse than what you're expecting.
She slid down under the covers a little farther and rested her head on his chest.
Know what I was just lying here thinking?
No. What?
I was just thinking you're going to have to pay it forward.
Me? Why me? Maybe he was doing this for you. You're his mother, after all.
Nope. I saw his notes. It said your name in one of those circles.
I think his idea was to get us married, though.
She fell silent, pulled away, rose, and began to dress. Before he could slip out of the house, he heard Trevor in the kitchen, pouring something that sounded like cereal, and there was no way out of the house that did not involve crossing by the kitchen doorway. He stopped quickly in the hall, and Arlene ran into his back.
What happened?
Trevor's up.
Well, of course Trevor's up. You don't ever sleep past 6, not even on a good day.
This is kind of embarrassing.
Why?
I'm his teacher.
So?
I'm not sure what to say to him.
How about the truth?
Oh, right, the truth. Trevor already knew parts of this, yet somehow Reuben hadn't thought to discuss it outright. Now it seemed he had no choice.
He stepped into the kitchen, where Trevor sat at the table in his pajamas, pouring milk onto a ridiculously large serving of Rice Krispies.
Hi, Mr. St. Clair.
Reuben sat down at the table with him. Arlene circled around to the stove and asked how Reuben liked his eggs. Reuben looked up, confused.
Who, me? Oh, I didn't know I was staying.
Got someplace you gotta be?
Well, no. Actually, no. Well, thank you. However you're going to make them for yourself is fine.
Scrambled it is.
Reuben turned his attention back to the boy.
You don't seem surprised to see me here, Trevor.
Trevor shrugged.
Your car's out front.
Good point.
Were you here all night?
Reuben shot a glance at Arlene, more a silent cry for help, really. But she was busy blowing on a burner trying to get it to light. Surely she could hear all this, but was leaving Reuben on his own.
Actually, Trevor, yes, I was.
Cool.
Trevor pulled the Sunday paper off the chair beside him and dug up the color comics.
Is that a problem to you, Trevor?
It seemed like a stupid question even as he heard himself say it, because most kids don't use the word cool to describe their problems. It was so far from the reaction he'd expected that it seemed he hadn't quite heard it yet.
It was practically my idea.
Another good point.
Are you two going to get married?
It's a little soon to think about that. But your mother and I do like each other.
I just knew you would. I just knew it. I sure hope you get married. I don't have too many new ideas for my project.
From Those Who Knew Trevor Speak.
When I got home that night, I called Lou, long distance. Wow, Lou said. You're getting laid. That's amazing. Wish I could say that. I tried to explain that something felt dishonest about it. It wasn't easy to explain. The only examples I could find involved my shame in being seen by Trevor the following morning, the feeling that I was doing him wrong by being there. He asked if Trevor seemed to mind, and I had to tell the truth. He pointed out that the only person who felt odd about it was me. I thought that meant I was worried about nothing. I'm used to that. It's a specialty of mine. That's what I wanted him to tell me, I think. That my anxiety was based on nothing, like a shadow with no mask behind it. Then, once he'd told me so, I thought it would disappear like a shadow flooded with light. That's not what he said. He said I was the only one who felt dishonest, and I was the only one who knew my intentions. Maybe my intentions were dishonest. I tried to dismiss his comment, but the minute he said it, I felt this great sweep of shame. I admitted to Lou something I'd never said out loud to anyone.
Arlene wasn't quite what I'd pictured for myself. She wasn't someone I'd usher into a room on my arm with great pride. In other words, he said, you're ashamed of her. Well, I didn't say that. Sure you did. All these thoughts started going around in my head at once, making it hard to breathe. I realized that this was her worst fear about me, that I looked down on her. Worst fears are always based on a grain of truth. That's what's so bad about them. I wondered if she had a friend she'd talk to like this. I wondered if she talked about my face and how hard it was to be physically close to me. Lou said, if you really want somebody else, go find somebody else. You're not doing her any favors. I said, no, I want her. It surprised us both. I just liked the way I felt around her, the way she made me feel, which suddenly seemed so much more real and important than wearing a woman on your arm. Lou told me a story about his most recent lover, a man who, like most men in his life, held him at arm's length until Lou couldn't take it anymore. I finally issued an ultimatum. Get the hell into my life, or get the hell out of it. If you want to stop feeling dishonest, Rube, try making an honest woman out of her. When I got off the phone, things began to look clearer. When he finally found it, the ring he knew was the right ring, he saw he would have to do all but drain his savings, which he hated to do. Rainy day money. It made him feel good just knowing it was there, but he knew it wouldn't be there for long. The ring wasn't big enough to be flashy, but it was big enough, set in white gold with smaller diamonds halfway around the band. A little old-fashioned, but he liked that about it. A little like his mother's, but not enough to be significant. It was just the right one, because he knew it was. He left the ring sitting in the store, went home, and obsessed about it. Decided to sleep on it, but he didn't sleep well. In the morning, he went by the jeweler's again, afraid it would be gone. When it wasn't, he put it on layaway, knowing he could still change his mind. But on his next breakfast table encounter with Trevor, he knew he had to do it. He looked at Trevor and knew. He couldn't buy a cheaper ring or cheapen their relationship by buying none at all. To do right by Arlene was to do right by Trevor. And, of course, himself. He had it in his pocket the next night when he took her out to dinner. She wore a rose-colored silk blouse and smiled openly, looking for all the world like someone he'd always known and always wanted, with no doubts in between. He stuck his hand in his jacket pocket and grasped the little velvet-covered box. He was sure. He almost brought it up, but missed the moment. But he would. It was only a matter of timing. He was sure. And she might not be. He'd been so busy with his own doubts, he'd forgotten to consider the very real possibility that she might say no. He took his hand back from his pocket and tried to forget the box was there. When he walked her to her door later that evening, they both claimed exhaustion. Reuben gave her a small, chaste kiss. The moment made him nervous and reminded him of the night she'd come into his arms unexpectedly with an offer of herself, right around the time he'd expected the kiss off. He'd loved her for that. Even as he ran away, everything else had been a game to avoid this very moment when he knew damn well she was what he wanted, and he knew also that something was wrong.
You okay?
She said. Her voice sounded faint, scared. Or he was scared enough himself to hear it that way.
Sure, why wouldn't I be?
I don't know, you seem kind of funny tonight.
I'm just tired.
Yeah, me too.
He called himself a coward on the way to the car. Halfway home it hit him, like waking from a dream. He could not imagine what he'd been thinking or why. He could not believe he'd almost said it out loud. He thought about Arlene, tried to bring her picture to mind, but she looked like a stranger. When he got home, he found the receipt for the ring in his drawer, right where he'd left it. Miss Liza jumped on the bed with him and rubbed against his chin. He told her everything, described the cliff from which he'd almost jumped. She agreed that humans were impulsive and strange, at best. He told her he'd return the ring in the morning, but he never quite got around to that. Chapter 16. Sidney G. For their benefit, he